Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is one of our favorite people to talk to, New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli. Welcome back, sir.
Alan, it's good to be back, although I feel bad we're doing it by phone, not in studio, but I've got my Alan Chartok bobblehead looking right at me, so I feel like I'm in studio with you.
Yeah, I'm not going to say anything that anybody who wants one can get a bobblehead of their own, and Tom DiNapoli won't be the only guy with it. So anyway, Tom, the first thing I want to talk to you about is that every time I turn around, I'm seeing that local governments are in some distress, this fiscal distress. They feel that somehow when we put a cap on the amount of taxes that people could pay and doing all of that, that they got hurt and they can't fund the requisite things that they need to do. What are you seeing?
Well, I'm seeing much the same. You know, we've talked a lot on your show in the past about the challenges facing the state and state budget, and there's been a lot of progress in that regard. But there's no doubt, as we continue to work through this post-recessionary time, the real flashpoint for fiscal stress is at the local level. Alan, particularly with our cities, our smaller cities upstate are the real front lines of stress. And they've been hit. The recession has decreased revenues. State and federal government, to balance their own budgets, have cut back or certainly flattened at the very least the amount of state aid that localities receive. Their fixed costs in many cases continue to go up, pension costs, health care costs, and so on. And then on top of it, as you point out, New York has the recently enacted property tax cap, which limits a revenue source that many of them depend on very heavily. So they're kind of getting it from all ends with fewer options than the state certainly has in terms of revenue sources. Tough choices about spending, tough choices about revenue. And in the short term, probably no end in sight with that.
So, well, now, didn't the Governor Cuomo say something about mandate relief for some of these towns and cities? Did he ever follow through on that?
Well, that's been one of the big points of contention. At the time the property tax cap was being not only discussed but implemented, the notion was that it would be coupled with more flexibility in terms of spending with regard to lifting mandates for local governments. There was a task force that was established. The task force became a permanent council. But I think it's fair to say that outside of picking up some more of the growth in Medicaid spending, which is mandate relief for counties, certainly in terms of the cities, the towns, the villages, they, I think appropriately so, say they're still waiting when it comes to the mandate relief part of the bargain.
Well, it's very interesting that you say that. Tom, the last guy in the world who would ever want to get my friend Tom DiNapoli into trouble with anyone else is, you know. But they are saying about, people are beginning to say about Cuomo that he keeps setting up these commissions and things, but they don't do much.
Well, you know, I think that mandate relief, we need to see what else will come out of that council. The newest creation
Well, keep hoping.
But the newest creation now in this year's budget is the local government restructuring commission that was set up. The goal there would be to help those localities in the greatest level of crisis, perhaps with a restructuring plan, perhaps with additional state aid that might come with that. As you know, our office is included in that. The commission hasn't met yet, but we'll see what comes with that. You know, what we've been trying to do, separate from what may be initiatives from the executive or the legislatures, we've set up an early warning system, a fiscal monitoring system, based on objective criteria to identify localities, town, cities, village, counties, school districts that are in stress. We don't do this to point fingers. We put out our first list in June. There are about 23 municipalities across the state that we found in various levels of stress. What we really are trying to do is make sure the local leadership is focused on the budget and financial challenges that they're facing. And we want the local citizens to know. You know, taxpayers and citizens need to have a clearer picture as to what's happening with their local finances, especially those that are in communities that are facing real budget challenges, because we want the public more engaged in the discussion of what the choices are. Even if they're tough choices, there are always better options. And I think a local government will come to a better selection among those options if the public is engaged in the discussion. So our fiscal monitoring system is really meant to be an opportunity for a community to get ahead of the problem, opportunity for us through the Comptroller's Office to provide our services in terms of risk assessment, budget audits, long-term financial planning assist to really help communities get out from under the fiscal challenges that they're facing.
Do you have this all up on a webpage?
So yeah, our Office of New York State Comptroller, whatever your search engine is, just put it in. We have all this information up there, both in terms of the different indicators that we use to determine stress and the first round of municipalities in stress that we put out in June. It's all up there on the website, with also information for local government officials and citizens to access in terms of some of the financial planning tools that we and budget planning tools that we make available to local governments. Alan, we don't want to be like California and some of those other states where you have cities filing for bankruptcy. I mean, that's the worst possible outcome. We've never had it in New York. The goal of this system is for us to get ahead of those kinds of financial meltdowns. You know, in past years, when we had more money, the state sometimes was able to literally help bail out communities. The state doesn't have that kind of money anymore. And as you also know, you know, starting with New York City, back in the 70s, we've had control boards or oversight boards. There's not a huge appetite for the creation of many more of those. So I am hoping our early warning system will be a way for communities to hopefully get ahead of the problem before it becomes a full-blown crisis.
Do the politicians who run these small communities sometimes get mad at you for saying that you're in trouble there, Jack?
Yeah. Well, you know, we've gotten more positive reaction than negative. I think part of what's helped us is that when we floated the proposal for this system, we didn't just say, here it is, this is what we're going to do. We put it out there. We sent it out to all the local officials across the state. We gave them 2 months and then some for reaction. We fine-tuned our proposal based on the reactions we got from local officials. So when we put out the list, I do think that in some cases some local officials didn't like the fact perhaps that they were on the list of stress. But I think most of them, even those that weren't necessarily thrilled with that, they took it in the spirit that was offered. And in most cases, I'd have to say, the local officials said, you know what, we know we have problems. The controller's office is validating what we've been trying to explain in terms of the problems. And the real value of the monitoring system is it's not a one-time. We're going to do this on a continuing basis. The real value is to be able to highlight trends and to see what direction is a community is going in. So we've had some of the communities that were listed in stress where they've said, yeah, but this view of a point in time, look where we were 2-3 years ago. In fact, we've been making progress. So I think when the local officials use this as another tool in their ability to communicate with their constituents what's going on, it was viewed positively. You know, not everybody likes to have to explain, you know, why they're in a certain condition, but we're not doing this it's not done in a point-your-finger way. It's not done in a political way. It's using very objective criteria that we spelled out from the get-go that we had input from local officials in developing. So I think, by and large, it's been received very positively.
Okay. Listen, Tom, now is the time to really try to get you in trouble. A new poll shows Elliot Spitz is leading in his comeback campaign for New York City offices, Associated Press. Days after launching a city comptroller bid, former Governor Spitzer shot to a 48-33% lead over the Democratic rival Scott Stringer among registered Democrats in the Quinnipiac University poll. Okay, so I guess I want to ask you this. He's running for comptroller. You're a comptroller on the state level. He'll be comptroller if he wins on the city level. Can you parse this whole thing for us?
Well, first of all, full disclosure, I've endorsed Scott Stringer for city controller, and that endorsement goes back a couple of months now.
Sure.
So, you know, I want to make that clear from the outset.
Yeah.
And by the way, Scott, I serve with the Assembly. He'll do a great job, and I think he's well prepared to be the city
controller.
Well,
he'll do a great job if he gets there.
Yeah,
right now,
yeah,
it doesn't
yeah.
look like he's getting there.
Well, polls are polls, though. You know, we'll see what happens with the votes. Obviously, there's a lot of storyline that goes with, you know, with Elliot's candidacy. I'm actually hoping that this will elevate the discussion of what a controller does. You know, one of the big challenges for me as state controller, even when I talk to an informed audience, is having to explain, you know, starting from square one, what it is a controller does.
Yeah,
what's the relevancy of the job?
But let's assume for a second somebody else gets elected mayor, you know, Mr. Weiner or Ms. Quinn or somebody like that, or Mr. Thompson. He's got it. How important is it that he'll be able to get along with them?
Well, the reality is that there's always a tension between a controller and the executive.
Oh, is there with you and the governor?
There's always a level of tension, institutional tension.
Sorry about that.
Boy, you really are. What did you have for breakfast?
I'm just trying to make trouble.
Yeah. But there's we've had some dust-ups, and people have said, well, what, you know, as a person, well, you know, you go back to the history of the role of this office.
Sure.
You've always had those kinds of dust-ups because
you have to audit his agencies, for example.
Audit and comment on budget and comment on fiscal practices. And I would suggest to you the controller's not doing their job if there never is a dust-up. There were times where Governor David Patterson didn't like some of the things we had to say. There were times where Governor Elliot Spitzer didn't like some of the things we had to say. But you know, that's our job, is not to be a rubber stamp for what the legislature and the governor are doing. It's to call it as we see it.
Okay, but what would you say, but Tom, what would you say about him? In other words, what should he avoid? I'm assuming he's going to get elected. You may not. But let's assume he does get elected for a minute. And he says, okay, now we're a big investor. Our pension fund, just like the state pension fund, is a big investor. Let's take a look at some of these corporations and find out whether they're doing the right thing here.
Well, that's a lot of what we've done. And, you know, we've talked about our engagement with companies. It's an important responsibility. I think the first thing he needs to do is recognize he's not an executive and he's not a prosecutor. And those are the positions that he's had. Being a controller is a very different role and responsibility. And you do have to wear different hats. You need to be the watchdog in terms of the city spending, city budget, the audits, as you mentioned, promoting an accountability agenda, but doing it from the perspective of rooting out waste, fraud, and abuse. But again, from an audit function perspective, you're not a prosecutor anymore. And when it comes to the pension fund, you always have to keep in mind, first and foremost, the fiduciary responsibility and the need to make money for the fund. So even if you have an issue you want to crusade on, and you may have your personal point of view on a particular matter, you have to take an action, if you're filing a shareholder resolution or engaging a company, not to promote a personal agenda or a partisan agenda. You have to promote an agenda that's consistent with enhancing shareholder value. That's what we've done effectively with the state pension fund. It's what whoever the city controller is has to do the same. John Liu does it now, Bill Thompson before him, and whether it's Elliot or Scott as the next city controller, that's what they have to do. But that's a very different role than pursuing some of those agenda as a, you know, as an attorney general, let's say.
Okay,
I think he needs to recognize he may have his opinions, but being a controller is a different role of responsibility. And in that regard, having done this job for a while, I'll be happy to mentor whoever becomes the next city controller.
But just so we get this last part that you just said, because, I mean, there are some companies that are making money, but they're making it at people's expense, health-wise or something else. So, for example, I know that cigarette companies have been in trouble before. Surely you could find something to invest your money in that doesn't do harm to people, right?
Yes, and we always certainly try to strike that right balance. But what you want to do with most of your investments is obviously stay invested. You know, that's how you are, number one, going to make money. And number two, if you stay invested in a company and work to change the culture, you know, on, let's say, a governance issue. Let's say, you know, as we focused on this past year, board diversity for their boards of directors. Women are woefully underrepresented on corporate boards of director, and it tends to be also limited diversity in terms of race and color and so on. So we've been striving, and we've achieved some successes in getting agreements this year with four companies, and we've been successful in a couple of shareholder votes, to include board diversity, particularly with regard to gender, as part of the criteria in selecting boards. Why? Because if you have a more diverse board membership reflecting the overall population, you're going to have better decisions. And there have been some academic studies that have shown that to be the case. Companies that don't have anti-discrimination provisions, we've been engaged with ExxonMobil. They have, unfortunately, a terrible record, and they don't recognize same-sex marriages as we do in New York and other states do. They don't recognize the benefits for their employees that are in New York. And part of it is that they don't have a clear non-discrimination policy. We've been pressing them. We haven't been successful yet. But that's an example where even if a company is doing something that we think hurts their bottom line, their value, if they're not encouraging a workplace where everybody feels they're going to be recognized not because of who they are, but because of the work that they do, we think that holds back the investment value, holds back the potential for our investment being fully realized. Staying engaged with that company and making them change. Environment issues, labor issues, go down the long list. You know, when BP had that...
How do you do it? You call them up? Do you call them up?
Well, we do different things. We might do a call. We might do a letter. We might have meetings. In the most extreme cases, we file a shareholder resolution. Sometimes that comes to a vote. Sometimes we win. Often we don't win. Very often when we take a more aggressive position, that compels a negotiation and we come up with an agreement.
Got it. Okay, got it.
Or two other things quickly. So, or one other thing, I'll just say we'll sue. You know, we'll have standing to do a class action suit or another kind of lawsuit.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing. That's what we did with BP after the Gulf oil spill. We're co-lead plaintiff on a class action suit against BP. But if we had pulled out, if we had sold, we wouldn't have standing to do these things. So that's why we do want to stay engaged to force change.
Okay. I got two other questions for you. Make sure we get them both in. The first is that the governor has appointed a so-called Moreland Act Commission to look into the way in which campaign finance is handled in New York, and the state legislators and others may be drawn into this because he's also had them appointed by the Attorney General, Deputy Attorney General. So I'm going to ask you a question. What do you think? I mean, you're a man on the scene. What does this mean to New York state politics?
Well, I certainly share the governor's frustration that at the end of the session there were no substantive changes in campaign finance law. And he indicated that if there were going to be no reforms, he proposed some, others proposed others, he would convene the Moreland Act Commission.
And by the way, just to, to interrupt for a minute, you have always been willing to start as a test case with the comptroller's office, right?
Back to 2007, I said, given the problems and how I got here, let's start with this being the office above reproach in terms of public financing and limiting campaign.
So that guys with a lot of money don't get to run for the office. Everybody gets an even break.
Yep, exactly. And also you take out the influence of private donations. So to me, you know, the jury's obviously still out as to what the Moreland Act Commission is going to do or come up with.
Sounds like you're being critical, that you think it's going to be just another,
I mean, one
of those commissions that's just going to, you know, sit around and collect dust.
I mean, look, they have a number of prosecutors on there, so if they come up with some specific instances of corruption, one would think that that could be easily referred then to the appropriate prosecutor to be dealt with. What I'm hoping the commission will enable, if I could use that word, I hate to use the word facilitate, it's overused, but so I'll say enable, is a blueprint for the kinds of reforms of limiting donations, having public financing. If the Moreland Commission can document the problems that are out there more clearly, I think we kind of know what they are, but maybe we need to be reminded, and say this is the roadmap for change, perhaps that will be the impetus to get the legislature to, in fact, adopt reforms. Alan, obviously, we're not going to have it in time for the elections next year. So it's very clear the 2014 election cycle is going to be back to, you know, for my office and the statewide offices, you can raise as much as $60,000 from one contributor. It's
and
crazy.
I just read something that the governor had been doing exactly that, getting a lot of money from very well-heeled people with agendas.
Well, and that's the part of the system that has to change.
But you've been very careful because your predecessors got themselves into a lot of trouble. You've had a very strict code of ethics about who you take money from.
Yeah, no, we did voluntary limits, and we asked the SEC, a Securities and Exchange Commission, to put in limitations in terms of those doing business with the pension fund. They've done that, so now actually what we've recommended is now the standard across the industry. But it means those who are probably the biggest givers in politics can't give to this race. So it
to
makes
your
it
race,
even more difficult.
Right.
Yeah, for the controller race.
You ever wake up difficult. In the morning and say, that was stupid?
No, I don't say that because it's the right thing to do. But, you know, look, if a self-funder comes in with several million dollars, you know, that's always going to be a vulnerability. I'd like to think that, you know, having a clean record and doing the people's business will be recognized by the voters. It happened last time. We were outspent 2-1. Let's hope it happens again in 2014, regardless of the opposition.
Okay, now we're done with that question. I'm going to a new one now.
Yeah.
There's a lot of push by the governor and others for casinos. And there's a question as to whether or not they will bring economic development into a particular area and whether they're good for New York State. Take it, Tom DiNapoli.
Well, I won't give you a yes or no on that, Alan, because we're actually looking at some of the current gaming revenues that are coming to the state, and hopefully we'll have an analysis of that, which will help voters consider where we're at today in the context of what they're going to be voting on in the fall. What I have said in the past, and I continue to feel, you know, there's a finite universe in terms of the money that people want to spend as far as gaming. And, you know, our bordering states, you know, as you know, Massachusetts, moving in that direction,
yeah.
Pennsylvania, obviously New Jersey's been there, Connecticut. You know, I do think that there's a limited amount of money, and if we keep having more and more casino-style operations, you know, and I don't have an answer to this question, but I think it's an appropriate question, will we be just recycling the same amount of money, or for it really to work for us in New York, will we have to, in effect, encourage more of this kind of activity, which I don't think would be a positive outcome. So,
no, but the governor sees, I think, gaming as a sort of cure-all or a helpful thing for upstate New York. Do you agree?
I think that's very much an open question. You look at the casinos at Atlantic City, the Connecticut ones, they may have been doing great at a certain point in time, but where are they at today? Because of the economy, because of competition? I think we have to face the same question. So even if something might be new and a novelty in the short run and have significant revenue increase, and you're seeing that, you know, at Aqueduct in terms of the activity there, what is the saturation point? And I don't have an answer for that.
And then there's also the morality question. I mean, do we really? I mean, there are some people who get caught in, up in this kind of thing, and but of course they can get on a bus and go somewhere.
And we do have the Indian casinos in New York already, and you have the racinos with the video lottery terminals. To a certain extent, I think the genie's out of the bottle on that. The question is how much further do we want to go? And that's a fair question to put before New York voters. So I'm hoping we'll have some more analysis on New York gaming revenues generally that'll be helpful to the discussion. But at this point, I think people should certainly ask the hard questions, and we'll see where this will go when the public will weigh in on this in the fall.
Have you ever gambled?
People might argue my choice of profession has been a gamble for many years now. But I've been to Atlantic City. I can't say that it is a significant entertainment activity for me, but the devil has tempted me, and now and then I've been known to do that. I can't say I've been particularly successful at it.
Right.
Of course, when the lotteries are really big on the Powerball, I do that because everybody else is doing it. You know, the herd mentality.
What would you do if you won?
Well, I'd be able to self-fund a race for controller.
Oh, yeah. That's true. But I often wonder what I would do. I mean, it's just a very, very tempting thing. I've fallen asleep at night thinking about it.
My guess is, based on the odds, that will continue to just be a dream for both of us.
Somebody's got to win. By the way, one of the most frequently asked questions I get, and we only have a couple of seconds now, is how come the money which was supposed to go to education from the New York State Lottery doesn't go to education? How do I answer that?
The short answer is it does go there, but it does not supplement. It takes a long way around. It becomes an accounting, bookkeeping, that when the state aid package is developed, the money from the lottery is then allocated to fund the state aid.
And so, do you have any questions for me?
How's your summer going? And don't pull any more saplings.
No. No, I had a little back surgery, and now it's getting better, we hope, and all like that. Tom DiNapoli, I mean, when you came into office, you had a number of doubters. I don't hear those doubters anymore. It sounds to me like you've really been doing a great job. And, that is not easy. As you say, it's a great gamble to run for political office. But, you know, I'm certainly not hearing much in the way of criticism for what you're doing.
Thank you. I have a great team. I love the work that we're doing here, and it's important work. It fits the challenge of the times, and hope we'll be here for a long time to come.
Do you watch other people around the country who have your job? Do the controllers have an organization, the international?
Yeah, there is. The job is different states. Sometimes it's an auditor job, a treasurer job, controller job. Sometimes, in New York, we kind of merged it all together. Yeah, we share thoughts, especially with those who are like me, the sole trustee for a pension fund, North Carolina, Connecticut. We talk a lot about what's going on. So we're all doing pretty well these days.
Yeah, and the market's doing pretty well, so you're doing pretty well.
That's always a plus, yes.
Yeah, and so when you wake up in the morning and the market has gone up, you feel good, and when it's gone down, you feel bad.
And March 31st is the day we value the fund, so week of most anxiety is the last week of March. So that was good. This year it was very good.
Yeah. Well, Tom DiNapoli, it's great to have you. You've always been a pal to come on and do this with us. If I've said anything that in any way troubles you, I apologize for it in advance. We are out of time. Our guest has been New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli. Tom, again, thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you, Alan.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org, and NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decision to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.